So, retrospectors, what historical events are we ticking off on this week's run of Today in History?
Well, Monday is the anniversary of the day Roger first published his famous thesaurus.
Then on Tuesday, we say happy birthday, Mr. Potato Head.
On Wednesday, the extraordinary stories of the child soldiers who fought in the American Civil War.
On Thursday, how King James changed the word of God.
And on Friday, what did spam emails look like in 1978?
We discuss this and more on Today in History with the retrospectors. 10 minutes every weekday, wherever you get your podcasts.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Hello, Man fans. Ollie Man here, and this is the monthly magazine show for your ears. Here's what's coming up today.
I made a beer that tasted of bin, and then I made a beer that tasted of armpit. I made a beer that my neighbour used as pesticide. I just went for a really bad run of making these beers.
What happens when your startup business dreams seem doomed to failure? I meet the man who brought beer to wine country. Plus,
knowing how to turn your down belows into a veritable slip and slide with lube is really useful for anyone going through pretty much any form of cancer.
Alex Fox on how to recover your mojo during cancer treatment. And Ollie Peart opens up his motherboard and becomes a fix-it guru. It's all to come on this edition of The Modern Man. But first, your letters, and hello to Jennifer Heron, who says, I loved last month's episode about the PI who pursues self-proclaimed psychics. Time after time, you guys put out interviews that become my weekend conversation. There will be no dinner party lulls after listening to this, she says. Thank you, Jennifer. I rather like the idea of you hosting a fraudulent psychic-themed dinner party. Perhaps everyone could get a snake-filled egg as a starter. Not everyone was convinced by that episode, though. Tim says, Ollie, I think Bob explained very well how psychics target vulnerable people, but my mind does boggle at how anyone can be taken in by them. And Robert says, rather more firmly, sorry, but if these morons have enough wealth to chuck six-figure sums at a medium, I have little sympathy for them. Well, I think the people we can all feel sympathy for are those of you who were trying to eat whilst listening to last month's Foxhole. My favourite comment about that was probably from Michael in Wankheim. It's in Germany, it's real. He says simply, I just think it's sad that everyone seems to have forgotten the real meaning of Pissmas. If you don't know what that's a reference to and you want to preserve your innocence, perhaps don't listen to last month's episode. Now, our guest this month, Tommy Barnes, was someone I spotted in Ferment magazine. He'd written a really funny piece, disarmingly honest, about his various failures to set up a brewery in the middle of French wine country. I thought it was really intriguing. And I thought two things. I thought, one, this would make a nice kind of feel-good episode for our summer edition. There's obviously a lot more to talk about here. And two, if I can get Tommy to agree to an interview, then I can legitimately use our production budget to fly to France for the weekend and taste beer. So I did, and that is what you're going to hear today. I mentioned this origin story because you can get a free copy of Ferment magazine yourself. It's a glossy monthly print magazine about the craft beer movement. It also, by the way, includes a monthly column by our very own Ollie Peart. Now you're sold, right? And you can get a free copy of that magazine by subscribing to Beer 52. They are our sponsors this month. They're the UK's number one craft beer club. Now, Ferment magazine by itself retails for £4.99 on the newsstand, but it is included each month in your beer box from Beer 52. You also get a free snack and, of course, eight delicious craft beers from around the world, curated by the guys at Beer 52, delivered to your door. All of that normally comes in at £24 a month, but if you want to try it out, you can get a free case just for being a Man fan. All you need to pay is the £2.95 postage. Just head to beer52.com/man. That is the word beer, the number 5, the number 2.com/MAN. Free beer. go for it. And thanks again to them. Right, in this month's episode, you will learn which niche website has 100 million visitors per year. You'll learn what the O-Nut is, and you'll learn which asparagus festival is the biggest in eastern central France. Let's go. Time for the Zeitgeist, your trends tested, with the man who insists on using the phrase "no wazza" in text messages like that's acceptable shorthand. It's Ollie Pitt.
How do you think shorthand comes to be a thing? People make it up.
I'll meet you at 4 o'clock at the Red Lion. No wazza.
I don't say it out loud. I've never said no wazza to you.
Exactly.
I just say it in text messages.
If you wouldn't say it out loud, don't write it down. That's good rubric. Your challenge in the last episode from Hannah from Swansea was to investigate the online fix-it community and dismantle and repair a device.
Mm-hmm.
Now, listeners will recall that we smashed your iPhone 4S, your old phone, I should say. We weren't that sadistic.
Yep.
On mic.
This is the screen. And it's worth knowing. Mm-hmm. They are glass.
Yes.
Lots of glass goes everywhere.
Yes.
And then, obviously, I got to work trying to fix the thing.
How?
Well, step one, order the screen. That's really easy to do. Go to Amazon, type in your phone. You can find screens for pretty much any phone you can find out there. So it's iPhone 4S screen, delivered next day, Amazon Prime.
Now,
Doddle.
Well, okay, now who's selling that? Like
some obscure random Chinese company.
Yeah, it's not user to user, my phone smash, but I'll sell you the screen. It is a company whose business is selling the screen.
Brand new screens, packaged, all ready to go. And they not only that, they come with, this is the bag of tools, they come with the tools to fit the screen.
Look at that.
Yeah.
That looks like a Christmas cracker present.
It does. Can you imagine that? A screen repair and a Christmas cracker. I'd actually love that. So you've got four screwdrivers.
You sound like my dad the first time he went to a pound shop. He was so thrilled. 6 toothbrushes. Guess how much? I get it, Dad. It's a pound shop.
And then I thought, I'm going to just try and fix this without looking at anything because I want to see if it's intuitive.
Yeah, but if we were talking about a Nokia 3310, I think that approach would be admirable and possibly appropriate. But we all know that Apple don't want you to repair their phones. They want you to buy a new one, preferably, or second choice, take it to the Apple store and spend 200 quid so they can fix it.
We say that, but in the bottom of the...
I do say that.
On the bottom of the iPhone 4S, there's 2 screws. And I thought, well, this is easy.
Okay.
Undo those, came out, started lifting it up, got one of those prizer things. I thought, this is where these come in. Mm-hmm. Put the prizer in. Broke it. I snapped the inside of the little screen bit and I failed. So, yeah, they really don't want you to get inside. So then I Googled it and it just threw up loads of information. I clicked on the first video and thought, I'll just follow this. And it was just a step-by-step guide, really simple, really dull, from DIYfixit.com. At the back of the phone, I found out you have to slide that off, then that comes off. And then I just started doing it bit by bit, just following the steps one by one. And before I knew it, I had a completely dismantled iPhone 4S in front of me.
Yeah, easier to take it apart than put it back together again, though, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, I don't need a guy telling me how to take it apart.
Not just that, but the video. So the video was titled, How to Repair an iPhone 4S Screen.
Yes.
No, it doesn't show you that.
No.
It just shows you how to take it apart. There's no video showing you how to put it back together.
Right.
So I had to search.
Literally no video.
Yeah. So I had to search for that then, which is irritating because I did it outside. The wind was getting up. The screws are really small. It was just really annoying. Putting an iPhone back together is probably more difficult than brain surgery. No, those Siamese twins that got taken apart by the head, not taken apart.
Conjoined, I believe, is the phrase we use nowadays.
Yeah. Those ones. It's harder than that.
Yeah, it isn't harder than that.
It definitely is harder than that.
I mean, for you, it might be equally as complicated, yes.
Here's what happened. I put it all together after lots of swearing.
Yeah, but hold on. You haven't ordered any new bits yet, apart from the screen. Just the screen.
Just the screen.
That's all you need.
Okay, yeah, but the screen, so I'll show you on the old screen.
Yeah.
So you look at it and you think, oh, it's just glass. It's just just the front. Mm. I just changed the front bit. No. It's the whole monitor.
It's a mirror. It looks like a compact makeup mirror.
Well, that's the other thing. It's really fascinating opening up the phone. I did find that interesting.
Yeah.
Like you get, I had to take the whole motherboard out. I saw what the vibrating bit in your phone looks like. It's amazing. It's like a magical world of technology hidden in your phone.
I mean, looking at the back of that, it doesn't look very high tech at all, does it?
Well, guess how much I paid for the screen.
I like this game.
This is a good game.
Okay.
Bearing in mind at the time, so iPhone 4S, they were quite expensive.
They were like £800 new. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'd say the screen should be 65.
It was about $8.99.
Wow!
$8.99. I know.
Shit.
Yeah.
I mean, for someone to make a profit on that, shipping it to you from China as well, that's incredible, isn't it?
That came with the tools.
I know that Apple spend a lot of money on developing these items and on marketing them.
Yes.
But when you think that the new iPhones are going for over £1,000 each, that's an extraordinary amount of profit, isn't it? If the screen costs them, presumably £3 or something.
Well, maybe it's like perfume. Maybe they just spend all the money on marketing and that's what we pay for.
Mm.
Maybe it's that. I don't know. But it's really cheap and it did surprise me.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I did it. Do you want to see?
Yes.
Okay, here it is.
That doesn't look like an original iPhone. Something has happened in the way that it looks.
Okay.
Now, it looks intact and I'm impressed. Don't get me wrong.
Mm.
I'm just saying, I don't know what it is, but something about this, like a matte rather than a gloss finish or something, from the outside, it doesn't quite, it looks like a market knockoff. Do you know what I mean?
I kind of know what you mean. I think I know what it is. So the screen, and I didn't realise this until I started getting to the final stages of this, didn't come with a fucking button.
Right.
This button.
So the then home, I had to, the home button.
The home button.
Yeah.
So I had to prise it out of the original one and bodge it in there. And if you look at it carefully, it's wonky. It's on the wonk because it's got the little square in the middle.
So are you saying you cut this circle yourself?
No. I had to prise it out of the old one and then stick it in there. But it's such an intricate, difficult task.
Oh, you've done really well.
It's really hard.
But isn't it interesting that like, because we're so familiar with looking at these devices, my brain didn't consciously know what it was that didn't look right. But something just felt a bit... It's the uncanny valley thing. Like, it's nearly perfect.
Yes.
But not quite.
Yeah. I know what you mean.
Does it work?
No.
Oh.
I know. It's so disappointing.
Oh, I was just about to say, like, you've aced it. You haven't.
And I know why it doesn't work. I'm just going to...
I mean, that's rule number one, isn't it? You know, if I take my broken phone to Ollie Pitt's sweatshop, I would like a fixed phone at the end of it.
Yeah.
Not a phone where you're like, oh, yeah, but I cut the button out.
I'll have a bash, mate, but... Might not work when I'm done with it.
Does it not turn on?
No, it doesn't even turn on. So, and there's a reason for that. So when this is the intricacy.
Ollie's now nervously playing with the tools as if to deflect from this line of questioning.
I'm not. I'm getting out. I'm filtering out of the tools all of the bits that I couldn't fix back on from inside. So there, I'm just going to hand you those components. You can describe those.
Yeah.
There you are.
Yeah, some of them look quite important.
That's really important.
I mean, some of them are just metal, aren't they?
Yeah, but they could be important. I've got no idea. I don't know
what
these are.
This one has a computer chip on the back of it. I don't know much about phone mechanics. But yeah. I imagine that the computerized components would take some form of priority.
This bit here, right, is actually off the new screen. So what you have to do is they're like ribbons. There's two of them. There's two of them on the device. And you have to put them through the back of the hole. It's all a bit boring.
Why waste your time with the tedious detail? The screen's on it. It looks nearly fine.
Listen, it got stuck. So I pulled it with some tweezers and it came off.
Right, I see.
And I thought,
did you know the moment
when
you've broken it? Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, because you kept the bit.
And I thought, I'm going to have to come clean here because it's not going to work.
What happens if you turn the button on? Do you get anything?
Just the click from...
That's a useful function, isn't it? Brilliant.
It's good for a Foley artist. You know, the archers could use that.
How much would you charge for this repair?
I'd probably give that one away free.
Yeah,
if I'm
really?
Honest. Yeah, yeah.
But you've got the click like a Foley artist.
Listen, it's really difficult. I tell you what, I have learned is if you want your phone fixed, take it to somebody who knows what they're doing. Oh no, actually, that's not true. Honestly, doing it was frustrating. But I did actually really enjoy it. It's quite therapeutic. It's like a puzzle, but a bit techie. And you get to sort of look into this hidden world of this phone. And I like that.
And a lot of people listening to this will have devices lying around the home that they're not using for anything anymore. They're not using as a remote control or a sat-nav or a camera. It's just sitting around.
Doing nothing.
You might as well take it apart and try and repair it as a hobby. I mean, actually, if you know that there's a chance you won't be able to get it back to life, then it obviously is quite an interesting thing to do if you're into that sort of stuff.
And loads of people are doing it. There's a subreddit called... Fix It. That's got 40,000 members. That's not the only one. There's several of these that have tens of thousands of members. You basically go on there and say, oh, I've got this screw. I don't know what it is. How do I get it out of this hole? And then people will message and comment. But probably the most popular and well-known like within the community is ifixit.com. And it's a massively successful website. It's like repair videos, it's got manuals, and they provide and make toolkits, so a little bit like this. They have 100 million visitors a year to this website. That's a lot of people.
That is a lot of people.
Going on, trying to fix all their little bits. And the thing is, big brands, brands like Apple, Samsung, Sony, all those guys, they hate it. Do you remember the warranty void if broken stickers? Mm. Like on TVs and all that kind of stuff. Those things are on there because big companies want to stop you from trying to fix the stuff.
Yeah, it was like you used to be able to get one of those pirated Game Boy cartridges that had 100 games on it. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
Which is obviously like perfectly possible to do, but Nintendo wanted you to buy, you know, each game for 30 quid, didn't they?
And when I was taking this apart, over each of those, or not all of them, but over some of the screws were just little black stickers. There's no marking on them, no nothing. They weren't there to hold the thing together. There's no like structural element to them at all. But once you remove them, you can't put them back. That's it. So if you took that to an Apple dealer and said, oh, yeah, can you fix it? It's not working. And they took it apart and they were like, yeah, but that's missing. So I know that you've tampered with it. That's why they do it.
That's the reason for it.
And you can't...
Which is strange when you've paid for the gadget. I mean, I know actually often, obviously, people get contracts, don't they? So possibly you're somewhere along the contract, you haven't technically bought the gadget. But if you have, it's yours. You should be able to do whatever you want with it.
Well, yeah, it's bigger than that because the software on it, you don't own at all. So you're licensed to use it. So it's these end-user license agreements.
Oh, yeah, the thing we all read in detail before we click agree.
It basically means that you don't own it. So tampering with it is something that you're not supposed to do. And it's not just in phones and things like this. It's like it's extending to farming and like hospitals and stuff. So you know the guys that make the tractors, John Deere, those big, like big massive combine harvesters and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
A couple of years ago, they basically have put end user license agreements on all of their combine harvesters and tractors. So if you spend £500,000 on one, you don't own it. So farmers are actually turning to hackers to get round it so they don't have to take it to a bloody dealer. Big companies hate it so much. So Google have like stopped serving adverts for third-party repair. So,
wow.
Yeah. So they won't serve those adverts. So if you Google it, it will show you like a local repair shop or whatever, but the adverts won't be served up. And this iFixit.com are petitioning the FTC in the States. They're trying to do this stateside at the moment to say... This is really bad. They should be allowed to advertise. So they really don't want you asking about in their phones.
And did you find any cool hacks in these Fixit forums? Not relating to necessarily your iPhone 4S, but are there people, I don't know, expanding the memory of their phones, they're twice as powerful for half the price, or putting the headphone jack back on the iPhone X or whatever?
Well, these iFixit guys, so what they do, every time a new phone comes out, every time a new iPhone comes out, they do a complete teardown of it. So they'll buy one and they'll just completely strip it to shreds. Mm. And they'll go, right, this does that, this does this. And they'll try and break down all of the technology within it and figure out how you can mend it yourself and all those kinds of things. And the reason they're doing that is because they're pushing. They're really pushing for this new legislation for right to repair. This is what they're calling it. They want everybody to be able to repair and be able to repair.
Mm.
Their devices, things at home, your toaster, your dishwasher, whatever, without all of these warranty void if broken kind of things. And in the United States, some of that legislation is being presented, but it's not getting through yet.
Very interesting. So if you're in this position ever again, if you break your phone accidentally, not on purpose, would you consider fixing it yourself?
Yeah, I would. And actually, I enjoy doing it so much, I've actually fixed other things at home. So I have fixed my old barbecue. And I used YouTube to do that. My barbecue did not work.
Charcoal or gas?
Gas.
Okay.
Didn't work.
I was going to say, fixing a charcoal barbecue, even I could
do. Yeah, fine. But it didn't work. It had gas leaks in it. So I learned what a gasket is. Didn't know what that was. And not only that, I learned how to make one from scratch. And it now works. And it is sat at home, pride of place. And yes, I've grilled halloumi on it.
That should be the end of every item. Challenge fulfilled, yes. Yeah. I've grilled halloumi on it.
Yeah.
Okay, well, time to hand over your challenge for next month's episode. It is from manfan Stefan from Coventry, who says, this summer, I have been re-listening to your interview with Belinda Kirk from a few years ago.
She was like an outdoor action-y... No, adventure lady. Adventure lady!
Yeah, basically.
Yeah.
That'll do. The episode is called Let's Live Adventurously, man fans, if you want to check it out in the back catalogue. And Stefan says... I have now been really inspired to go on some micro-adventures of my own.
Good for him.
But, he says, where should I start? I challenge Ollie to try some micro-adventures of his own and report back on the best.
He basically wants me to be a travel agent. Have I got that right?
It's summertime, Ollie.
Yeah.
We've got long days. Mm. We've got relatively clement weather.
We're actually getting shorter. And it's raining today.
You live in the countryside.
Mm.
Can you, perhaps on the way to work?
Yeah, but like what?
Perhaps just like after a nice Sunday lunch, go out, pop out and report back on the best one. So like wild swimming.
Wild swimming.
Or cliff jumping. Any cliffs near you?
Not jumping off that. I hear it's quite dangerous.
Free sleeping. You tried that one? That's where you basically sleep outside but without a tent. I don't know why.
Yeah, okay.
Don't be so reticent.
No, I'm not.
Time.
It's just, I'm not going to have the time to do this. And if he wants a mini adventure, go and Google it.
It's a micro adventure.
Mm.
And the whole point of a micro adventure is that it is micro. You fit it around your everyday life. So this, you have got time to do this. You just don't realise you have.
So I go to work, adventure, go to work.
I look forward to hearing your report. And if you have a challenge for Ollie to complete by the October edition of the show, do reach out via the feedback form on our website, onemanwithtwoends.co.uk. In a moment, you will meet Tommy, the beer missionary. It is a very summery listen, so stay with us. But next, our record of the month. It's called Wolf. It's by singer-songwriter Lion. And it's out now.
I held your hand and I let it go in the water. It's time that I stop pretending I need your cover. Will we ever know if it's now or never? And it's fine to put my hands up and surrender. Free from what we know. What?
Man fans, just a brief reminder before this month's middle feature that this podcast, though free to download, is not free to produce. If you enjoy what we do, please support our independent podcast by donating $5 a month. We call it beer money because the average price of a pint of beer in Britain is £3.60, which is about $5. But you can choose to give us any amount you want, as little or as often as you want. We have a secure, customizable web form at modernmanwith2ends.co.uk/beer, and there is a PayPal link there as well if you'd prefer to use that. Every penny goes back into supporting this show. Thank you. And speaking of beer, let me introduce you to Tommy Barnes. His is a story you'll relate to if you've ever dreamt of walking away from a steady but boring corporate job and starting up your own business, following your passion project. For years, Tommy worked as an in-house graphic designer in London. Hailing from a family of Francophiles, he'd always fancied emigrating to the Loire Valley, French wine country, a place he'd visited on childhood camping holidays. Then, one day, he had a killer idea for a startup business. He could see a gap in the market.
I would say France is maybe 10 years behind the UK in terms of craft beer. So now you're just starting to see the big IPAs and things in BrewDog and Brooklyn Beer. They're the sort of the well-known craft beers, and you're starting to see them in the supermarkets. And so that's how it starts. People start drinking them, and then they understand that beer isn't just this watery alcohol for a summer's day sitting outside a cafe. I remember telling people in the UK that I was going to go and start a brewery in France, but I don't think I ever really planned to. I'd started brewing with a friend of mine who was into craft beer, so that was my only experience really at that stage.
How did you do that?
Well, he was brewing homebrew, so I'd go around his house, basically try not to mess anything up, and then happily drink his beer when it finally fermented.
And did you find the process, I mean, interesting?
I thought it was witchcraft. I was amazed that you could make beer in your own home, and beer that tasted all right. And I think that possibly was the seed of it. You could make a decent beer without being a trained brewer and without hugely expensive equipment.
Did you think you'd do one of these trendy Shoreditch punk type beer companies, or were you not thinking that far in advance?
I never think that far ahead. I never But I knew I loved those IPAs and things. So those were the beers that I was interested in. And so those were the beers that I first decided I would make. I didn't particularly enjoy my job, but it paid the bills. So I'd sit in the office all day getting bored, then go home, go to the pub, which for a long time I quite enjoyed, but eventually that does get boring.
And so if you've been in one office for quite a long time, because you were working there for over 10 years, weren't you?
Yeah.
It must be quite difficult to take the plunge and actually commit to a dream that seems that bonkers. Your only experience working is effectively in this one company, and your only experience making beer is, you know, under your mate's stairs.
People often look back at it and tell me that it was bonkers, but it always seemed a natural thing to do. We got offered redundancy at our work. It was
we being you and your now
my,
wife
and my wife. We worked together, and that's where we met. We were being priced out of London. We were having to move into smaller and smaller flats just to survive. And we were both at the point where we'd had enough and we wanted to get out.
And you can't make beer in a flat.
Well, you could, but not much beer. I didn't really make beer at all until we moved to France.
So this is the barn.
This is it, the dépendance in French, which is just an outbuilding.
It's not just an outbuilding, is it? That's doing it a disservice. How old is this thing?
End of the 19th century, I think. So what's that, 120 years old, 130 years old?
So would people have actually made wine in this at one point? Are you sacrilegiously making beer in it?
I am. When we cleared it out, there were wine presses. But then it was used to store animals as well. There's various troughs and things. But there are no animals left, you'll be pleased to know. My wife's a ceramicist as well, so we knew we wanted space for her studio. And I think we did say, I think I was looking for somewhere to start a brewery as well. So like with the space to start brewing beer.
Well, except, I know this is only partially true because there was also a novel.
That's right. Originally, I mean, I said to people I was going to start a brewery in France, but I don't think I ever really thought I was going to. My original plan when I moved to France was I was going to write a best-selling comedy murder mystery, which I did then write, but it turned out it wasn't a bestseller. In fact, I sent it to every single publisher and agent in the UK, and it was widely panned by all of them. I think it might be the worst murder mystery ever written.
Do you think that now?
Looking back on it, yeah. And some of the feedback I've got on it, yeah, I think it was.
I mean, at the time, did you think I've written something really good?
I think I must have thought it was all right, because I finished it. It took me about a year, I think, to write it.
So I'm just trying to put myself in your shoes. So, yeah, so you've given up on London life, your job in London. You've moved with your girlfriend to the middle of a place you don't know at all.
Yes.
With a vague dream of setting up a brewery, but then really it's about writing a best-selling murder mystery that then you've written and people are telling you is crap.
Yeah.
That must have been hard.
It was hard. And it was at that point when I turned to beer, both drinking beer and I thought, I've actually got to do something to earn a living here. So I will start a brewery. I told people I was going to start a brewery, and then I had to do it because that was my only real way of making money, I think. And there aren't many breweries around here. So, I mean, there was a gap in the market. Once I started the brewery, I think then I began to get worried, and I started to realise that I was in the middle of one of the biggest wine regions in France, probably the world. But it was too late by then. I'd already started the brewery, and we had to try and make it a success.
I mean, I'm trying to think. It's almost a bit like trying to open a Café Rouge in France. In a way, you're going to a place where they've got a massive wine culture and saying, take my British interpretation of American IPAs, that's what you really want.
Yes, I thought I was going to change these people's worlds with IPA beers. It took me about a year to get through the French bureaucracy before I could get all my permits to start selling beer. So I started brewing for about a year, just testing out recipes and things.
That must have been very frustrating at the time. Was that quite useful to have a year to experiment?
Incredibly useful. Even by a year, I mean, I wasn't making great beers, but they were a lot better than when I started.
Talk me through how. I mean, I cannot imagine the complex chemical details of what is actually happening to produce starch and malt and whatever, but basically, how do you make beer?
Well, I'll tell you it basically, because I'm not much of a chemist, so I understand enough to make what I would say is good heartfelt beer, but master brewers are chemists, and I'm not that. But it's very simple. You have malt, which is barley, which has then been lightly kilned.
Where do you get that from?
So I buy that from, there's a maltery in central France that I buy that from in big sacks.
Okay, so you don't need a kiln?
You don't need to, no, it's all done. That's all malted, yeah. You get it delivered to you.
Get your kilned malt, yeah.
Yeah, you grind it.
Uh-huh.
Then you soak it in warm water, which converts the starch to sugar. Then you pass the liquid, which is now a sugary liquid, through into another vessel.
And how many days do these steps take?
This is one day. You brew in a brew. In okay. Sort of, my brew takes about 7 hours, I think.
Okay.
You pass it into a boiler, effectively. You boil the water for an hour and a half.
Okay, just on that. You boil the water in, you say a boiler.
Yeah, it's actually
like a big fire or?
No, it's just a big vat, which is with elements. Mine's got elements in. You can get gas.
Okay.
Gas heated.
It's almost like a big catering hob, almost.
Yeah, it's not far removed from a hot water boiler in a house.
And at every step of this process, does it stink? I'm imagining it does.
It smells quite nice, actually. But if you leave it till the next day before you clean up, then it does start to stink. And beer gets everywhere as well, especially the way I brew. I flood the brewery probably about once a week at various stages of the brew. So it can get a bit smelly in there. But when you're brewing, it's wonderful. You put the hops in and the hops smell fantastic.
Okay, so it strikes me that even though you're sort of located in the wrong place for that process, the internet's made it all a lot easier. You found out resources into how to make the stuff, but also how to literally get the ingredients delivered to you.
I mean, we live in the countryside, and I think 20 or 30 years ago, we wouldn't have been able to do this at all. But with the internet, you're on a level playing field with everyone else. You can get anything you want. I can get all the ingredients that anyone else can get delivered, and I can make the same beers that they're making in a trendy brewery in London. My first brew, I brewed in the barn here. It was interrupted by my dogs. I left the malt that I'd used out in the garden. We've got two dogs. They found the malt, started eating it, and then started vomiting everywhere in the garden. So I had to rush out halfway through the brew and try and round these dogs up. By the time I got back, the water boiled all over the...
Oh no, at the crucial moment.
The crucial moment. It burst up over the little brewery and covered the floor. It was a catastrophe, but I managed to chuck it in the fermenter and stuck it under the stairs, because at this stage I was just brewing tiny, tiny amounts. And then it just started to bubble away under the stairs for a week, and it was incredible. It was as if I had created life. And that's one wonderful thing. When it starts to bubble, it's like a heartbeat.
So talk me through the first time you tasted your own product.
I thought it was the greatest beer ever made. and on reflection, it wasn't. But there's just something about making something alcoholic that doesn't taste horrible, which was enchanting.
How do you know what ratio of things to put in?
Originally, I started trying to make a beer like my favourite beer, which is called Big Job, which is made by St Austell's Brewery in Cornwall. And that's just a really strong, very hoppy IPA.
And so the opposite of what they like to drink.
The opposite
here,
of what they like to drink, saying, yeah. And I could find ingredients online, but I couldn't find the quantities. So I just had to guess, really. And that was the start of the process of a year of just doing that, moving things around. And eventually my beers now are nothing like that particular beer, because I've gone in my own direction just through experimentation.
And, I mean, okay, you thought it was magical.
Yeah.
Did your wife respond in the same positive way?
No. I think it's fair to say she didn't.
I mean, she's pregnant at this point, right?
She was pregnant with our first child, yeah.
So a lot depends on you actually getting this right now. Your novel's not worked.
And so it was all on the brewery at this stage. One of the most important things about brewing is you've got to be clean and tidy. I had lots of brews that went wrong because I wasn't clean and tidy. But I had a eureka moment when my neighbour, Monsieur Richard, who lives over the road, invited me over to do some gardening. with him to help him out with his garden. And he's got this most immaculate garden. And I describe it as the Sistine Chapel of gardens. And the way he worked was incredible. He was so thorough. His favourite words are impec, which is impeccable, and prop, which is clean or proper. And I realised that his gardening equipment was cleaner than my brewing equipment. That was the moment I thought, if I've really got to butt my ideas up and be more like Monsieur Richard. And from then on, I started taking it more seriously and my beers improved a lot.
In taste as well as hygiene?
In taste, yeah, because the hygiene is the key. If you get bacteria in your beer, it ruins it.
Hmm.
So, yeah, I made a beer that tasted of bin. And I've looked online subsequently and they tell you about all sorts of off flavours in beer, but I've never seen bin.
No, so and it was very specifically that smell bin, you get from a random selection of things in the trash.
Yeah, the sort of the bin liquid, you know, that you get at the bottom of the bin. And then I made a beer that tasted of armpit. I made a beer that my neighbour used as pesticide. He says quite effectively. I just went for a really bad run of making these beers and I realised it was because I was trying to cut corners. I wasn't doing things properly.
So you're having conversations with all these French neighbours. So you speak French, presumably.
I speak functional French.
Was that enough to deduce whether the local French people here thought there was any market for a brewery in the town?
I think the local people thought it would fail, but they didn't want it to fail. Everyone was incredibly supportive, but I think just generally it's hard to start businesses around here. And someone that doesn't really know how to brew beer, trying to brew beer in French wine country, probably didn't seem like the best bet as a going enterprise. So, I think they probably thought it would fail. But saying that, they were all incredibly helpful. I've had people coming around helping me with build the brewery. The mayor of the town, when I couldn't get the electricity company to give us enough electricity to run the brewery, the mayor of Braloo phoned up the electricity company on my behalf and basically threatened them until they came round and fixed it. People have been very supportive, but somewhat dubious of its success.
Because you're not actually employing anyone here, are you? This is a business for you and your family at the moment.
That's right. So I'm the only person that works there. But
so you literally personally brew every bottle that you make?
I brew bottle and label every single, and cap every single bottle.
Wow.
Yeah.
So what's the cost per bottle to you? Have you ever done that maths?
To this day, I've never written down the figures. I know roughly what a bottle costs me to make and what I sell it at, and it's not a bad margin. And that just makes it really simple for me because it just means I know I just have to make lots of beer and sell it. But I've never done business plans or anything like that.
Well, it's not factoring in your time either, is it? Even if you're making a great markup, the fact that it's your whole life, you couldn't expect someone else to work for you on that basis, I guess.
No, that's it. So if I'm, last week I was in the brewery till midnight, two nights in a row, just finishing my bottling. And under French labour laws, I'm pretty sure you can get an employee to do that.
When was the first time you tested out your product with the public?
Well, the first big test was at the Fête d'Asperges, which is the asparagus festival in the village.
Of course.
Yeah, I'm told it's the biggest asparagus festival in eastern central France, so you've probably heard of it. It's actually
Was there not a beer festival to go to?
Funnily enough, there is a beer festival, but it's not really a beer festival. It's called a beer festival, but actually they just drink, I think, like Kronenbourg and then dance. So it's not a beer festival as we would know it. But the Fête d'Asperges is basically an excuse to get drunk. There's probably as many bars lined up the road as there are asparagus stalls.
I mean, there's only so much asparagus you can do in a day.
Exactly. It's not that interesting, is it, asparagus? Luckily, they didn't know. I didn't really know what I was doing. And the fact that I was English gave me some kind of a kudos.
Right, so you were like one of those French guys selling sausages and cheese in the market in England.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Who were probably just putting on a French accent.
Yeah, so it's something a bit exotic about being the English beer
guy.
Yeah,
exactly. And so, that actually probably was to my advantage. So we set up this stall at the asparagus market. It started off really badly, I remember. But then Monsieur Richard came over and bought some beer from us. And he's quite well known in the village. And when people saw him buying beer, they then came over We sold all of our beer, I think, within 2 hours. We sold everything.
And this was an IPA-type beer?
By this stage, I was making a blonde beer.
Ah.
My neighbour, Damien, had been telling me for a year I had to make blonde beer. And I kept ignoring him and saying that, you know, they'll come round to the IPA. And eventually, after a series of disasters, I decided to take his advice. And it was immediately my best-selling beer, the blonde beer. And I named it after my neighbour, who Damien, who was suggesting it. So it's called Berger Blonde. And I thought he'd
be...
Is
that his surname?
Yeah, that's his surname. I thought he'd be really happy about it. But it barely registered when I told him. For the first year, I couldn't make enough beer. I was selling beer in Bralu, and everybody who lived in Bralu was interested. It had Bralu on the label, so everybody bought it. What I realised was the further I got from Bralu, the less cachet the name had. The first summer went really well, but then we hit winter, and it was then that I realised it was a seasonal beer, because then people just stopped buying it, and... It became tough. I think I'd expected to sell a lot of beer over Christmas and through winter. And suddenly, I mean, we were selling virtually nothing. There were times when I couldn't sell the beer over winter, and it really, it just seemed impossible. And it seemed like it was all going to go tits up, and we'd have to, you know, go back to England with our tails between our legs. We scraped through, I remember, just sitting in the living room. At that stage, did we have a log burn? I think we still had an open fire, just huddling around a fire for the whole winter, just doing what we could to survive. But then as the sun came out again, people started buying beer again, and I'd had the opportunity to build up a lot of stock over winter. So the first summer I didn't have enough stock to get me through, but the second summer I had quite a lot.
Because production isn't seasonal. You can do it all year round, can you?
It's harder to make beer in the summer for someone like me, because I haven't got much equipment. And one of the most important things is keeping fermentation temperatures at a level. And in summer here, it gets very hot. I think it got up to 40 degrees last year.
It was also quite unpleasant for you in a barn as well.
It was really, really uncomfortable.
I mean, so people do not think about that, do they? When they're thinking they're going to start their own craft beer brewery.
No.
That they're going to be on their knees stirring things and picking up kegs.
Wading into giant cylinders to dig out malt and hops and sludge. I mean, it's messy work, and it's hard work, a lot of it. And the big work is the bottling and labelling, and that's just tedious. That's just 2 days of to, you know, very repetitive, boring work. So it's not glamorous, brewing beer. I also realised that I needed to start expanding and selling into bars and restaurants and shops, because markets are great on a summer's day. But, you know, if it's pouring with rain and there's no one there, you're sitting there and you're wasting all time that you could be brewing beer or bottling. I remember a woman just trying one of my beers and just not even looking me in the eye, just saying "fad," putting the glass down and walking off. And it affected me so much that I went back to the recipe and started doing various different things. And when really I should have been a bit more objective about it. But what you realise is everyone has different tastes, and people like one of my beers and not the other one, and that's all fine, you know.
And what about the opposite? Have you had people, without knowing that you're the brewer, order it because they like it in front of you? Have you seen people get drunk on it who don't know that you're the brewer?
Yeah, there's a bar in Richelieu, and sometimes I go past. He's one of my big supporters, the guy that owns it, and he stocks all my beers. And so sometimes I go past and people are drinking my beer outside on the terrace, and I see my bottles and my logo that I designed, and that's a great feeling, seeing that and seeing people enjoy it. Sometimes you get people who just assume that you've bought the beer in from somewhere else. People are quite surprised that there's a little brewery in Bralu. I often get asked if it's from England, the beer, that I'm importing it from England and things like that. And so when people find out that I'm I'm actually making it, then they get, I think, probably more interested and are probably more forgiving of it, because they love artisanal products and products that are made locally. And
does it bother you that this local market doesn't appreciate the nuance and complexity of beer in perhaps the way that you'd want it?
On some levels, possibly, because, you know, you want people to appreciate the work you're putting into it. But at the same time, there's a hardcore of elderly French women who come to buy my stout, which is my dark beer.
Interesting.
Every Friday. And I don't really know why they buy it. I suspect they might be using it for cooking, which is, on one hand, quite disheartening.
In what?
I think maybe stews. I think they cook it, okay, rabbit stews, yeah, with it.
I was going to say pies doesn't feel like the right thing.
No, I don't know. I don't think they do.
In the Loire?
Yeah. But I think they use rabbit stew. But then on the second, the other hand, I'm quite flattered that they deem it good enough to put in their stew. So.
And what would they have been using before, actually? Would they be going to the supermarket and buying Guinness? They
probably, yeah, probably, or yeah, I should think so.
So you've given them a local alternative, which they prefer.
Which they prefer, yeah. But you know, I would prefer to drink it.
Now we've got two different sizes of bottles here.
As long as they're buying it, it's
fine. A small one like you'd expect to see in a pub, and then one that's like a bottle of wine, which I don't have ever seen ale served like that before.
People asked me for bottles that size round here, so I think it's really for sort of sharing at the table.
Yeah,
that's the idea behind that. Originally, I just started with small bottles, but people demanded the big bottle.
Okay, can I taste them?
Yes. So we've got four beers. We'll start with the blonde beer. It's a Belgian style beer, really. Belgian beers are, generally speaking, quite well carbonated, so they have quite a lot of fizz.
So this is the one that you reluctantly made and is now your big seller?
It is, yeah.
Okay, cheers.
Cheers.
Oh, it's really nice. It sort of tastes like Leffe or one of those sort of Belgian beers. I've drunk those kinds of blonde things, but then there's...
It's got honey in it as well.
When you said that they drink it to be refreshed on a cold, on a hot day, that is exactly the vibe that I'm getting from drinking. You want to be sitting outside, preferably just before a meal, and quaffing a load of that to cool off.
Yeah, that's it. It's quite a strong beer as well. Traditionally in France, beer's an apéritif, so... You might have one glass before dinner and then move on to a wine or something like that.
So might you be able to, do you think, translate some of the people that are buying your blonde beer into IPA customers after all?
I think so, because it's happened everywhere else. That's why I believe it will happen here. It's happened right across the world. I mean, France, they're particularly proud of their own tradition. So I think it will be hard to win people over, but I'm certain it will happen. And the beer's good. I'm proud, but also just really relieved, you know, because it's something, then you have confidence when you sell it, you have confidence when people try it. Whereas before, you know, it was terrifying going to a market, giving people samples of beer that you didn't think were that great. I mean, it's sort of soul destroying. We're in a position where I had to sell whatever I made because we needed the money. And so it was a toss up really between getting the quick buck then against my, you know, while my reputation would suffer, or just not selling beer at all. But the truth was, we needed money, so I had to go out and sell beer that I wasn't proud of. And I will never forget that. They were markets that were horrible. So now, just to be, even if people don't like my beer, I know that it's a decent beer, because it's subjective. You know, some people like some beers, some like others. And so I'm confident and happy to go and sell it now. But yeah, there were times when it was very difficult.
But you've got two kids now.
Yes.
And you've been here for a couple of years. It sort of has to work now, doesn't it? In a way that when you were starting and it was a bit of an adventure, wasn't so relevant. You're a beer maker now.
I am. And as you say, we've got two children that we have to feed. So it has to work. And it's still on a knife edge. Winter again was difficult. But I've brewed a lot, I've got lots of stock, and it's good beer.
I'd like to taste one you're the proudest of.
Well, probably, I think my IPA probably is the beer I would choose to drink.
So this is a large bottle, like a wine-shaped bottle, but slightly smaller, with a red label, Cardinal IPA.
The label stayed the same, but the beer has changed a lot. Originally, it was a sort of West Coast IPA, which are the IPAs that perhaps we're most familiar with, sort of Sierra Nevada, beers like that. But I've gradually changed the recipe, and now it's more of a New England IPA, which is a cloudy IPA with very little bitterness and a very fruity flavour and aroma.
Mm. Yeah, see, that is more to my taste than the blonde one, even though I like the blonde one. This is less gassy, more fruity.
And that's all from the hops. I try and use European hops, which is unusual. This sort of beer, normally you'd use American or Australian hops or New Zealand hops. The thing is, I mean, there are so many good beers like that that I felt like I needed to have a point of difference. So I'm using new varieties of European hops to make similar beers.
And for people listening in the UK or anywhere in the world who want to drink your beer now, having just heard you rhapsodise about it for half an hour, they can't.
No, absolutely not. You have to come to Bralu or Richelieu, the local town, to sample it at the moment.
Why is that?
Well, I did look into exporting it, but the customs and excise in France are notoriously bureaucratic, and they put me off, really. I think they just didn't want to have to fill out the forms. But, I mean, the problem is I produce such a small quantity that importing it would be very costly at the moment. There might be ways around this, so going to a larger importer and
So is this a problem with the scalability of your business? Like, now you've actually got a successful product here, potentially. Can you make it bigger here? Can you start at least distributing it to, I don't know, Paris?
I probably could, but I don't know if I want to. Really, one of the big things about the life here is people want to earn enough money to live, but money isn't the be-all and end-all of it. And I think in London, I felt that it got to the point where money was no longer the means to an end, but it was the end for a lot of people. And quality of life had sort of taken a back seat, whereas here that's not the case. So expanding the brewery, if I can earn enough money with the brewery that I've got, then I'm not sure I want to expand it. I'm not sure I need to export beer or send it to Paris and things like that.
And that quality of life that you're talking about includes the work, because you're doing something you enjoy. I mean, you may not want ultimately to bottle literally personally every bottle that comes out of your brewery. Maybe that gets a bit tiresome.
Yeah, I would like some better equipment. Absolutely.
But you like selling it. You like being involved. You like being hands-on.
I do. I love it. I mean, the lifestyle here is much easier and more relaxed, but I'm probably more stressed than I ever was in London. But it's okay. I don't mind that, because it's just being stressed about something I love doing, and something that matters, and you know, it feels like we're living over here. Whereas in London, I think we'd got to the point where we weren't really living. We were going through the motions.
A lot of people listening to this will have similar dreams. It might not be that they want to start a brewery, but they'll have an idea of something they really like, a passion project that they have that they'd like to do for their living. But they think, well, it isn't convincingly a living. I'm never going to be able to make that happen. I shouldn't take the risk.
You should think it through more than we did, or certainly more than I did. But at the same time, you have to, at points, you have to embrace your inner idiot and switch off your brain and just go for it and attack. Because I think you can talk yourself out of anything if you think about it too long. But I know that it's still on a knife edge. I know that if I haven't sold enough beer this summer to get us through next winter, then we're in big trouble again. But, I mean, that's part of what makes it fun in a way. You know, it's living. It's what I didn't have in England.
Tommy Barnes. He may have floundered in his career to write a murder mystery novel, but he has written a highly entertaining memoir about all of that. It is called A Beer in the Loire. It's out now from Muswell Press, and I'll put a link on our website, modernmanwith2ends.co.uk. That, of course, is where to head as well if you would like to suggest a future guest for an episode of the show. We don't have time to reply to every email, but we do read them all. And yes, you can even nominate yourself. Time for our monthly trip down the foxhole next. Alex Fox will be here after this.
It's time for the Foxhole Your Sex Questions with Alex Fox. Hello.
Are you ready to get wetter than you ever have before in the foxhole?
Can you not tell from my face that the answer to that is surely a resounding yes?
Well, I met someone recently who is literally a super soaker. She is the queen of flicking the bean. Her name is Lola Jean. And get this, Ollie. She holds the world record for the largest volume of squirt, as in female ejaculation squirting, ever produced within a 30-second time period.
What an accomplishment.
1,215 mils of liquid.
Okay, I mean, there are many questions here, but amongst them, how is this independently adjudicated to be the case? Because I can't imagine the people from Guinness would proudly turn up for this photo shoot.
She did actually contact Norris McWhirter to see if he would become Norris McSquirter.
Yeah, don't worry. I was already at the punchline by the time you gave us the setup.
And was sadly told that the Guinness Book of Records is a family publication,
yes,
and they were declined to be involved. So she put on a bit of a carnival and got a big crowd of people to witness this event.
And did someone video this for posterity?
I did video it myself.
Oh, well done.
So I'll show you that after the recording if you want, Ollie. But you can see Lola in person performing either at workshops in the UK, but she's a resident of New York City, where she actually puts on an amazing show at the Box called Splashdance.
Couldn't make it up. Okay.
You can mop it up.
Time for your questions. People often get in touch about all sorts of sexual quirks. This is an unusual subject we're going to cover today. It is cancer. We've been contacted by two different anonymous women about cancer and sex after cancer diagnosis. The first one says, "Hello, Alex. I'm a 30-something single lady who has been given a cervical cancer diagnosis. This should be sorted with radical trachelectomy surgery. My question is that post-surgery, I'm really, really worried I won't get my very, very active sex life back. So, Alex, how can I get my mojo back? And in the very likely event of a smaller, shorter vagina post-surgery, how can I get my bits back on form to take a good dicking?" Her words. Okay, so that's the first question. And the second question we've had is from another lady in her late 30s. She says, "I've been going through breast cancer treatment. As my cancer is hormone-related, the docs are suggesting ovarian removal or long-term injections to suppress ovarian function. I know this will move me into menopause. So, Alex, can you please speak about the best type of lubes to use in this situation?"
Well, first up, I just want to applaud both these women for getting in touch to talk about the big C and SEX, because this is just not spoken about enough. In fact, the charity Macmillan, who specialise in talking about cancer, recently ran a survey and found that 1 in 5 people who had experience of cancer, that's around 500,000 people in the UK alone, found it really difficult to seek help or to start conversations about certain side effects or experiences that they were having related to their illness because of embarrassment, shame and taboo. We're talking about things like anxiety and depression, bowel and bladder problems, financial issues. A lot of people get into monetary trouble because they can't work in the same way that they used to. And of course, sex and relationship issues. In fact, the latter were the number one taboo problem that people in the UK who'd gone through cancer found really difficult to talk about. Over half of them, 57%, said they just couldn't speak up and they didn't know where to go to find resources. So I'm really glad that we're addressing this.
Yeah, absolutely. And you can sort of see how that happens, even though, of course, that feeling of shame or oppression is wrong, you know, looked at objectively. You can see why if you're telling your friends, your family, your support network, "I've got an illness that might kill me," you feel like you've used up a lot of your points there. You're not going to go back to your friends and say, oh, and this is having an impact on my sex life as well. Like, how do you start that conversation?
Yeah, and I think a lot of people who are going through cancer and who are survivors, who've gone through that treatment, feel like they ought to be so grateful just to be alive.
Exactly.
That they're not allowed to complain, or they're not allowed to ask for a higher quality of life. Healthcare professionals as well, and doctors, I think, find this a very difficult subject to address because they're not quite sure how it will be received. They don't know the right moment to bring up sex and relationship and intimacy issues because they don't want to offend people. And as a result, what happens in the dark, or what doesn't happen in the dark because people are in too much pain or too much distress, just is not addressed. And we have to change that.
Okay, so let's do it. The First Lady says she's going to have essentially probably a shallower vagina after this.
So she's going through a radical trachelectomy. A trachelectomy is an operation to remove most of the cervix and the upper part of the vagina. I spoke to a wonderful friend of mine called Lavinia Winch. She's been through exactly the same scenario. And she said that after her treatment, frankly, penetrative sex was like having a Chinese burn at first. Mm. But what she said to me is, first up, it's quite common that your doctor will talk to you about the use of dilators. You insert them inside the vaginal canal, and what they do is primarily stop you sealing while you're healing. Sometimes if you've had an operation, or also if you've had something like pelvic radiotherapy, which can cause some scarring and some soreness, they stop the wounds from adhering together, from sticking. Secondly, they also help to very gently stretch that scar tissue or stretch that area to make it a little bit bigger. Some that were recommended to me by people who have personal experience of cancer can be found on a website called Soul Source Therapeutic Devices. They've got harder ones, they've got softer, like velvet touch silicone ones. They've got ones with notches on, which mean that it can be easier for you to track your progress of how deep you're going. And that can make it easier to talk to your doctor as well, because you can show them on a dilator, or you can say, I'm up to notch number three, I'm up to notch number four.
And so I can see how all of that would help restore the shape of the vagina, but are there any gadgets out there that can actually help with the sexual sensation?
Let me tell you about a brand new gadget called the O-Nut, O-H-N-U-T, and it's kind of a coit for coitus, if you will. It's a series of three little squishy donut-shaped silicone rings, and what the male partner does is pop those on the penis, and they act like a buffer so that essentially he can't penetrate too deeply. It means that both partners don't have to worry about him accidentally going too far or too much prodding causing pain, but they still retain sensation for both partners. Mm-hmm. When you're ready, you can take one of those O-Nut rings off for a slightly deeper penetration, but they allow you to have a guided step by step, if you will, reintroduction to penetrative sex when you're ready. External vibrators can be really useful if you're concentrating more on the clitoris rather than the internal vaginal structures. Mm. And that can be a useful way of restoring pleasure in this scenario. I've spoken about the womanizer before, which is a type of vibrator that uses air pressure rather than hitting against the skin. That is recommended by a lot of people who've been through cancer. They've got a new version out that's a lot smaller than before called the Womanizer Starlet. As a result, that can be easier to use during partnered sex.
Okay, well, hopefully all of that will help our anonymous contributor facilitate her good dicking. Moving on to the second lady, who's got the ovarian removal potentially on the horizon. She's talking about lubricants. What can we advise her?
Knowing how to turn your down belows into a veritable slip and slide with lube is really useful for anyone going through pretty much any form of cancer, because things like surgery, chemotherapy, radiotherapy, hormone related treatments can all leave you a bit high and dry in your down below areas.
Yeah, I didn't know that. I mean, that isn't talked about, is it? It's not discussed, really.
No, and a lot of people who are going through breast cancer, understandably, just focus on their breasts. Yeah. And they think it's all about the tits and don't think about their bits. But if you have a type of breast cancer that responds to estrogen, then you may well be prescribed a certain medication. There's a very popular one called tamoxifen, which doesn't stop your body from producing estrogen, but it does prevent the body from processing it by blocking the receptors. Unfortunately, one of the side effects of that is that it can set off the menopause and all of the wondrously difficult symptoms that go along with that, such as the ability of the vagina to make moisturiser.
Okay, what should they lube up with?
One of the best lubricants on the market for people in this situation, which doesn't contain any ingredients that are likely to upset your system or cause further aggravation, is called Yes. You can actually get this on prescription from your GP, which may prove cheaper than buying it over the counter. There's another one called Silk, S-Y-L-K. As well as just getting your hands on some lubes, what you might want to do is actually layer your lubes up. So that means applying a water-based lubricant to the vaginal area and then an oil-based lubricant to your toy or your boy. And if you think about how oil floats on water, that makes the experience even more slippery, even more gliding and friction-free, and even more long-lasting. Just, of course, as ever, be aware that oil-based lubricants don't get along with condoms.
And as well as lubricants, there's vaginal moisturisers, aren't there?
Well, a lubricant is designed to stop friction, whereas a vaginal moisturiser, just the same as what you'd put on your face, actually moisturises the tissues themselves. There's all sorts of ones on the market. Unfortunately, some of them are more stable than others. Some have a tendency to sort of separate after a while into a delightful cottage cheesy curds and whey effect, which is neither helpful nor particularly sexy. Again, though, Yes, make a really good vaginal moisturiser. There's quite a new product that's about to be available on the NHS called Intra Rosa. It's actually licensed for use by people who are experiencing painful sex due to vaginal atrophy or menopause brought on by cancer treatment.
And so whilst you apply the lubricant shortly before sexual intercourse, actually the moisturiser you presumably put on once a day...
The moisturiser you can
use... With your T-zone.
Yeah. The moisturiser you can use as and when you want to. And it's important for me to stress that even if you're not somebody who wants to have sex or is having penetrative sex, vaginal moisturiser can just make day-to-day living a lot more comfy.
Fascinating. And further reading for those affected by this issue?
For someone who is dealing with breast cancer, check out Breast Cancer Havens. Please also check out the work of Liz O'Riordan. She's a breast surgeon who, somewhat ironically, has had recurrent breast cancer. She writes a great blog, really frank, really honest.
And for those who are having trachelectomies?
I check out the work of Sam Evans. You can find her at SamTalkSex on Twitter. And also, please do go and see Karen Hobbs. She's a comedian who talks about her own experience of gynecological cancer. Not only has she got some great advice, but she might make you laugh. And let's face it, if you're going through that, you need a fucking good giggle.
And we'll put those links on our website, modernmanwith2ends.co.uk, which is also where you should head, Alex, to submit a sexual question for a future edition of The Foxhole. And if people want to follow you on social media, they can do so at...
A-L-I-X-F-O-X.
And with that, we have very nearly reached the end of this month's Modern Man, but there is just time to appoint a new manbassador. It's Gav in Oxford, who says, "Thank you for producing such a thought-provoking series. I can safely say I take something from every episode, even the ones I start off thinking, I have no interest in this." Thank you, Gav. Well, we'll know if that's still true because you'll only hear this dedication if you're still listening. He says, "I have been a Beer Money supporter for a while, but never put my name forward to be a manbassador as I just assumed there would already be one for Oxford. But I now see on the interactive globe there isn't. Well, Gav, there is now. I now pronounce you manbassador for Oxford, the dreaming spires. She needs not June for beauty's heightening." Until next time, our theme music is by Django Django. I've been Ollie Mann, the producer Matt Hill, and we'll see you next month. Yeah, running like a wolf now. Wild before the sun down. Nothing's gonna take away my grace. Yeah, howling at the moonlight. Don't wanna let my soul. Jump into these flames. Something saved my life. Next time on The Modern Man.
What I learned was that the reason I couldn't get it up with a girl was that porn had messed my brain up. So for me, it came about rewiring your brain, which is something, which is a phrase you will find a lot on NoFap forums, is that you have to rewire your brain, reboot. It's called the reboot.
At just 19 years old, Sebastian was affected by impotence. Follow his journey through the online NoFap movement and the world of porn-induced erectile dysfunction. Download it September 1st, wherever you get your podcasts.